Okay. He came back to her. There was no blood on him that she could see, not even a spot. How was that possible? How long has she been out? Okay, okay. He ran the hand, not holding the knife, through the short, stupidly expensive tailorization of his hair. It sprang right back into place. Who's Deke Hollis? The drawbridge keeper, she said. Her voice was unsteady, wavering. We talked about you. That's why I stopped to look in. She had a burst of inspiration. He saw the girl. Your niece, he called her. Yeah, yeah, the girls always go back by boat. That's all he knows. That's all he knows in the world. Are people ever nosy? Where's your car? Answer me now or you get the new special, a breast amputation. Quick, but not painless. The grass shack. It was all she could think of to say. What's that? The little conch house at the end of the quay. It's my dad's. She had another burst of inspiration. He knows I'm here. Yeah, yeah. This didn't seem to interest Pickering. Yeah, okay, right, big time. Are you saying you live here? Yes. He looked down at her shorts, now a darker blue. Runner, are you? She didn't answer this, but Pickering didn't seem to care. Yeah, you're a runner. Damn right you are. Look at those legs. Incredibly, he bowed at the waist, as if meeting royalty, and with a loud smack, kissed her left thigh just below the hem of her shorts. When he straightened up, she observed with a sinking heart that the front of his pants were sticking out. Not good. You run up, you run back. He flicked the blade of the butcher knife in an arc, like a conductor with a baton. It was hypnotic. Outside, the rain continued to pour down. It would go on that way for 40 minutes, maybe an hour, and then the sun would come back out. Em wondered if she would be alive to see it. She didn't think so. Yet this was still hard to believe. Impossible, really. You run up, you run back. Up and back. Sometimes you pass the time of day with that old man in the straw hat, but you don't pass it with anyone else. She was scared, but not too scared to realize he wasn't talking to her. Right. Not with anyone else, because there's nobody else here. If any of the tree-planting, grass-cutting beaners who work down here saw you on your afternoon run, will they remember? Will they? The knife blade ticked back and forth. He eyed the tip, seeming to depend on this for an answer. No, he said, no, and I'll tell you why. Because you're just another rich gringa running her buns off. They're everywhere. See him every day. Health nuts. Have to kick him out of your way. If not running, on bikes, wearing those dumb little potty helmets, okay? Okay, say your prayers, Lady Jane, but make it quick. I'm in a hurry. Big, big hurry. He raised the knife to his shoulder. She saw his lips tighten down in anticipation of the killing stroke. For M, the whole world suddenly became clear. Everything stood out with exclamatory brilliance. She thought, I'm coming, Amy. And then, absurdly, something she might have heard on ESPN. Be there, baby. But then he paused. He looked around, exactly as if someone had spoken. Yeah, he said. Then, yeah? And then, yeah. There was a formica-topped island in the middle of the room for food preparation. He dropped the knife on it with a clatter instead of sticking it into Emily. He said, sit there. I'm not going to kill you. I changed my mind. Man can change his mind. I got nothing from Nicole but a poke in the arm. There was a depleted roll of duct tape on the island. He picked it up. A moment later, he was kneeling in front of her, the back of his head and the naked nape of his neck exposed and vulnerable. In a better world, a fairer world, she could have laced her hands together and brought them down on that exposed nape. But her hands were bound at the wrists to the chair's heavy maple arms. Her torso was bound to the back by more duct tape, thick corsets of the stuff at the waist and just below her breasts. Her legs were bound to the chair's legs at the knees, the upper calves, the lower calves, and the ankles. He had been very thorough. The legs of the chair were taped to the floor, and now he put on fresh layers, first in front of her, then behind. When he was finished, all the tape was gone. He stood up and put the empty cardboard core on the Formica Island. "There," he said. "Not bad. Okay. All set. You wait here." He must have found something funny in this because he cocked his head upward and loosed another of those brief yapping laughs. "Don't get bored and run off, okay? I need to go take care of your nosy old friend, and I want to do it while it's still raining." This time he flashed to a door that proved to be a closet. He yanked out a yellow slicker. Knew this was in here somewhere. Everybody trusts a guy in a raincoat. I don't know why. It's just one of those mystery facts. "Okay, girlfriend, sit tight." He uttered another of those laughs that sounded like the bark of an angry poodle, and then he was gone. Six. Still 9:15. When the front door slammed, and M knew he had really left, that abnormal brightness in the world started to turn gray, and she realized she was on the verge of fainting. She could not afford to faint. If there was an afterlife, and she eventually saw her father there, how could she explain to Rusty Jackson that she had wasted her last minutes on Earth in unconsciousness? He would be disappointed in her. Even if they met in heaven, standing ankle-deep in clouds while angels all around them played the music of the spheres arranged for harp, he would be disappointed in her for wasting her only chance in a Victorian swoon. M deliberately ground the lacerated lining of her lower lip against her teeth, then bit down, bringing fresh blood. The world jumped back to brightness. The sound of the wind and downrushing rain swelled like strange music. How long did she have? It was a quarter of a mile from the pillbox to the drawbridge. Because of the slicker, and because she hadn't heard the Mercedes start up, she had to think he was running. She knew she might not have heard the engine over the rain and thunder, but she just didn't believe he would take his car. Deke Hollis knew the red Mercedes and didn't like the man who drove it. The red Mercedes might put Deke on his guard. Emily believed Pickering would know that. Pickering was crazy. Part of the time he'd been talking to himself. But at least some of the time he'd been talking to someone he could see but she couldn't. An invisible partner in crime. But he wasn't stupid. Neither was Deke, of course, but he would be alone in his little gatehouse. No cars passing, no boats waiting to go through either. Not in this downpour. Plus, he was old. "I have maybe 15 minutes, she said to the empty room. Or perhaps it was the bloodstain on the floor she was talking to. He hadn't gagged her, at least. Why bother? There would be no one to hear her scream, not in this ugly, boxy concrete fortress. She thought she could have stood in the middle of the road screaming at the top of her lungs, and still no one would have heard her. Right now, even the Mexican groundskeepers would be undercover, sitting in the cabs of their trucks, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. 15 minutes at most. Yes, probably. Then Pickering would come back and rape her, as he had been planning to rape Nicole. After that, he would kill her, as he had already killed Nicole. Her and how many other nieces? Em didn't know, but she felt certain this was not, as Rusty Jackson might have said, his first rodeo. 15 minutes, maybe just 10. She looked down at her feet. They weren't duct-taped to the floor, but the feet of the chair were. Still, "You're a runner. Damn right you are. Look at those legs." They were good legs, all right, and she didn't need anyone to kiss them to make her aware of it, especially not a lunatic like Pickering. She didn't know if they were good in the sense of beautiful or sexy, but in utilitarian terms, they were very good. They had carried her a long way since the morning she and Henry had found Amy dead in her crib. Pickering clearly had great faith in the powers of duct tape, had probably seen it employed by dozens of psycho killers in dozens of movies, and none of his nieces had given him any cause to doubt its efficacy. Maybe because he hadn't given them a chance. Maybe because they were too frightened. But maybe, especially on a wet day, in an unaired house so damp she could smell the mildew. Em leaned forward as far as the corset's binding her would allow, and gradually began to flex the muscles of her thighs and calves, those new runner's muscles the lunatic had so admired. First just a little flex, then up to half. She was approaching full flex and starting to lose hope when she heard a sucking sound. It was low at first, barely more than a wish, but it got louder. The tape had been wrapped and then rewrapped in crisscrossing layers. It was hellishly strong. But it was pulling free of the floor just the same. But slowly, dear God, so slowly. She relaxed, breathing hard, sweat now breaking on her forehead, under her arms, between her breasts. She wanted to go again at once, but her experience running the Cleveland South Track told her she must wait and let her rapidly pumping heart flush the lactic acid from her muscles. Her next effort would generate less force and be less successful if she didn't. But it was hard. Waiting was hard. She had no idea how long he had been gone. There was a clock on the wall, a sunburst executed in stainless steel, like seemingly everything else in this horrible, heartless room, except the red maple chair she was bound to. But it had stopped at 9:15. Probably it was a battery job, and its battery had died. She tried to remain still until she had counted to 30, with a delightful Maisie after each number, and could only hold out to 17. Then she flexed again, pushing down with all her might. This time the sucking sound was immediate and louder. She felt the chair begin to lift, just a little, but it was definitely rising. Em strained, her head thrown back, her teeth bared, fresh blood running down her chin from her swollen lip. The cords on her neck stood out. The sucking sound became louder still, and now she also heard a low, ripping sound. Hot pain bloomed suddenly in her right calf, tightening it. For a moment, Em almost kept on straining. The stakes were high, after all. The stakes were her life. But then she relaxed within her bonds again, gasping for air, and counting. One delightful Maisie, two delightful Maisie, three. Because she could probably pull the chair free of the floor in spite of that warning tightness. She was almost sure she could. But if she did so at the expense of a Charlie horse in her right calf, she'd had them there before. On a couple of occasions, they'd hit so hard the muscle had felt like stone rather than flesh. She would lose more time than she gained, and she'd still be bound to the fucking chair, glued to the fucking chair. She knew the clock on the wall was dead, but she looked at it anyway. It was a reflex. Still 9:15. Was he at the drawbridge yet? She had a sudden wild hope. Deke would blow the warning horn and scare him off. Could a thing like that happen? She thought it could. She thought Pickering was like a hyena, only dangerous when he was sure he had the upper hand. And, probably like a hyena, wasn't able to imagine not having it. She listened. She heard thunder and steadily whooshing rain, but not the blare of the air horn mounted beside the drawbridge keeper's cabin. She tried pulling the chair off the floor again, and almost went catapulting face first into the stove when it came free almost at once. She staggered, tottered, almost fell over, and backed against the formica-topped service island in the middle of the kitchen to keep from doing so. Her heart was now running so fast she couldn't detect the individual beats. It seemed to be just a steady, hard hum in her chest and high in her neck, below the points of her jaw. If she had fallen over, she would have been like a turtle lying on its back. There wouldn't have been a chance in the world of getting up again. "I'm all right," she thought. "It didn't happen." No, but she could see herself lying there all the same, and with hellish clarity. Lying there with only the swash of blood made by Nicole's hair for company. Lying there and waiting for Pickering to come back and have his fun with her before ending her life. And he would be back when? In 7 minutes? 5? Only 3? She looked at the clock. It was 9:15. She hunched beside the counter, gasping for breath, a woman who had grown a chair out of her back. There was the butcher knife on the counter, but she couldn't reach it with her hands bound to the chair's arms. Even if she could have grasped it, what then? Just stand there, hunched over, with it in her hand. There was nothing she could reach with it, nothing she could cut with it. She looked at the stove and wondered if she could turn on one of the burners. If she could do that, then maybe. Another hellish vision came to her, trying to burn through the tape and having her clothes catch on fire from the gas ring instead. She wouldn't risk it. If someone had offered her pills, or even a bullet in the head, to escape the possibility of rape, torture, and death, likely a slow one, preceded by unspeakable mutilations, she might have overcome the dissenting voice of her father. "Never give up, Emmy. Good things are always just around some corner or other." And gone for it. But risking the possibility of third-degree burns all over the upper half of her body? Lying half-baked on the floor, waiting for Pickering to come back, praying for him to come back and put her out of her misery? No, she wouldn't do that. But what did that leave? She could feel time fleeting, fleeting. The clock on the wall still said 9:15, but she thought the beat of the rain had slacked off a bit. The idea filled her with horror and kindled fresh panic. She beat it back. Panic would get her killed. The knife was a can't, and the stove was a won't. What did that leave? The answer was obvious. It left the chair. There weren't any others in the kitchen, only three high stools like bar stools. She guessed he must have imported this one from a dining room she hoped never to see. Had he bound other women, other nieces, to heavy red maple chairs that belonged around a dining room table? Maybe to this very one? In her heart, she was sure he had, and he trusted it, even though it was wood instead of metal. What had worked once must work again. She was sure he thought like a hyena in that way, too. She had to demolish the prison that held her. It was the only way. And she had only minutes to do it. 7. It's probably going to hurt. She was close to the center island, but the counter stuck out slightly, creating a kind of lip, and she didn't trust it. She didn't want to move, didn't want to risk falling over and becoming a turtle, but she did want a surface wider than that projecting lip to beat against. And so she started toward the refrigerator, which was also stainless steel. And big. All the beating surface a girl could want. She shuffled along with the chair bound to her back and bottom and legs. Her progress was agonizingly slow. It was like trying to walk with a weird, form-fitting coffin strapped to her back. And it would be her coffin if she fell over. Or if she was still whacking it fruitlessly against the front of the KitchenAid when the man of the house returned. Once she tottered on the edge of falling over, on her face, and managed to keep her balance by what seemed like willpower alone. The pain in her calf came back, once more threatening to become a Charlie horse and render her right leg useless. She willed that away, too, closing her eyes to it. Sweat rolled down her face, washing away dried tears she did not remember crying. How much time was passing? How much? The rain had slackened still more. Soon she would start to hear dripping instead of raining. Maybe Deke was putting up a fight. Maybe he even had a gun in a drawer of his cluttered old desk and had shot Pickering the way you'd shoot a rabid dog. Would she hear a gunshot in here? She didn't think so. The wind was still blowing pretty hard. More likely Pickering, 20 years younger than Deke and obviously in shape, would take away any weapon Deke might produce and use it on the old man. She tried to sweep all these thoughts away, but it was hard. It was hard even though they were useless. She shuffled forward with her eyes still closed and her pale face, swollen at the mouth, drawn down in effort. One baby step. Two baby steps. May I take another 6 baby steps? Yes, you may. But on the fourth one, her knees, bent almost into a squat, bumped against the front of the refrigerator, Em opened her eyes, unable to believe she had actually made this arduous safari safely. A distance an unbound person could have covered in 3 ordinary steps, but a safari for her. A fucking trek. There was no time to waste congratulating herself, and not just because she might hear the pillbox's front door open any time. She had other problems. Her muscles were strained and trembling from trying to walk in what was almost a sitting position. She felt like an out-of-condition amateur attempting some outrageous tantra yoga position. If she didn't do this at once, she wouldn't be able to do it at all. And if the chair was as strong as it looked... But she pushed this thought away. "It's probably going to hurt," she panted. "You know that, don't you?" She knew, but thought Pickering might have even worse things in mind for her. "Please," she said, turning sideways to the refrigerator, giving it her profile. If that was praying, she had an idea it was her dead daughter she was praying to. "Please," she said again, and swung her hips sideways, smacking the parasite she was wearing against the front of the fridge. She wasn't as surprised as when the chair had come free of the floor all at once, almost causing her to flip head first onto the stove, but almost. There was a loud cracking sound from the chair back, and the seat slewed sideways on her bottom. Only the legs held firm. "It's rotten," she cried to the empty kitchen. "The damn thing's rotten." Maybe not actually, but, God bless the Florida climate, it sure wasn't as strong as it looked. Finally, a little stroke of luck. And if he came in now, just as she'd had it, Emily thought she would go insane. How long now? How long had he been gone? She had no idea. She had always had a fairly accurate clock in her head, but now it was as useless as the one on the wall. It was uniquely horrible to have lost track of time so completely. She remembered her big clunky watch and looked down, but the watch was gone. There was just a pale patch where it had been. He must have taken it. She almost swung sideways into the fridge again, then had a better idea. Her bottom was partly free of the chair's seat now, and that gave her extra leverage. She strained with her back as she had strained with her thighs and calves while working to free the chair from the floor, and this time, when she felt a warning pain way down low, just above the base of her spine, she didn't relax and wait and recycle. She didn't think she had the luxury of waiting anymore. She could see him coming back, running right down the center of the deserted road, his feet spatting up sprays of water, the yellow slicker flapping. And, in one hand, some sort of a tool. A tire iron, perhaps, that he had snatched from the blood-stained trunk of his Mercedes. Em strained upward. The pain in the small of her back deepened, took on a glassy intensity. But she could hear that ripping sound again as duct tape let go, not of the chair, but of itself, of the overlapping layers of itself, loosening. Loosening wasn't as good as freeing, but it was still good. It gave her more leverage. She swung her hips against the refrigerator again, letting out a little scream of effort. The shock jarred through her. This time the chair didn't move. The chair clung to her like a limpet. She swung her hips again, harder, screaming louder. Tantra yoga meets S&M disco. There was another crack, and this time the chair slewed to the right on her back and hips. She swung again, 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 pivoting on her increasingly tired hips and smashing. She lost count. She was crying again. She had split her shorts up the back. They had slid down crooked over one hip, and the hip itself was bleeding. She thought she had taken a splinter in it. She took a deep breath, trying to calm her runaway heart, small chance of that, and whacked herself and her wooden prison into the refrigerator again as hard as she could. This time she finally struck the lever of the recessed automatic ice dispenser, releasing a jackpot of cubes onto the tiled floor. There was another crack, a sag, and all at once her left arm was free. She looked down at it, stupid-eyed with amazement. The arm of the chair was still bound to her forearm, but now the body of the chair hung askew on that side, held to her by long gray strips of duct tape. It was like being caught in a cobweb. And of course she was. The crazy bastard in the khaki shorts and Izod shirt was the spider. She still wasn't free, but now she could use the knife. All she had to do was shuffle back to the center island and get it.
"Don't step on the cubes," she advised herself in a ragged voice.
She sounded, to her own ears at least, like a manic grad student who had studied herself to the edge of a nervous breakdown.
This would be a very bad time to go skating.
She avoided the ice, but as she bent for the knife, her overstrained back gave a warning creak. The chair, much looser now but still bound to her midsection by those corsets of tape, and at the legs as well, banged into the side of the island. She paid no attention. She was able to grasp the knife with her newly freed left hand and use it to saw through the tape binding her right arm, sobbing for breath and casting small, darting glances at the swing door between the kitchen and whatever lay beyond. The dining room and the front hall, she assumed. It was the way he had gone out, and the way he would probably come back in. When her right hand was free, she tore off the broken chunk of chair still bound to her left arm and tossed it on the center island.
"Stop looking for him," she told herself in the gray, shadowy kitchen. "Just do your work."
It was good advice, but hard to follow when you knew your death might come through that door, and soon. She sawed through the band of tape just below her breasts. This should have been slow, careful work, but she couldn't afford to go slow and nicked herself repeatedly with the tip of the knife. She could feel blood spreading on her skin. The knife was sharp. The bad news about that were those repeated nicks just below her breastbone. The good news was that the duct tape split away without much argument, layer after layer. Finally, it was cut through from top to bottom, and the chair sagged away from her back a little more. She set to work on the wide band of tape around her waist. Now she could bend further, and the work went faster, with less damage to her body. She cut all the way through at last, and the chair fell backwards. But its legs were still bound to her legs, and the wooden feet suddenly shifted, digging in low on her calves, where the Achilles tendons surfaced like cables just below the skin. The pain was excruciating, and she moaned miserably. Em reached around and used her left hand to push the chair against her back again, relieving that horrible digging pressure. It was a filthy angle, all wrong for her aim, but she continued to press the chair to her, while she shuffled around so she was once more facing the stove. Then she leaned back, using the center island to relieve the pressure. Gasping for breath, crying again, she wasn't aware of the tears, she leaned forward and began to saw through the tape binding her ankles. Her exertions had loosened these bands and the others binding her lower body to the fucking chair. Consequently, the work went faster and she cut herself less frequently, although she managed to give herself a fairly good slash on the right calf, as if some mad part of her were trying to punish it for seizing up while she was trying to push the chair free of the floor. She was working on the tape, holding her knees, the last ones left, when she heard the front door open and close.
"I'm home, honey," Pickering called cheerfully. "Miss me?"
Em froze, bent over with her hair hanging in her face, and it took every last scrap of will to get moving again. No time for finesse now. She jammed the blade of the butcher knife under the belt of gray tape binding her right knee, miraculously avoided stabbing the tip into her own kneecap, and hauled upward with all her strength. In the hall, there was a heavy cluck sound, and she knew he had just turned a key in a lock, a big lock from the sound. Pickering wanted no interruptions, probably thought there had been interruptions enough for one day. He started up the hall. He must have been wearing sneakers, she hadn't noticed before, because she could hear them squelching. He was whistling "Oh, Susanna." The tape holding her right knee parted, bottom to top, and the chair fell backward against the counter with a noisy clatter, now bound to her only at the left knee. For a moment, the footsteps beyond the swing door, very close now, stopped. And then they broke into a run. After that, it all happened very, very fast. He hit the door two-handed, and it burst open with a loud thump. Those hands were still outstretched as he came racing into the kitchen. They were empty, no sign of the tire iron she had imagined.
The sleeves of the yellow slicker were pulled halfway up his arms, and M had time to think, "That's too small for you, asshole. A wife would tell you, but you don't have a wife, do you?" The hood of the slicker was pushed back. His power haircut was finally in disarray. Mild disarray. It was too short for anything else. And rainwater dripped down the sides of his face and into his eyes. He took in the situation at a glance, seemed to understand everything.
"Oh, you annoying bitch," he bellowed, and ran around the counter to grab her.
She stabbed out with the butcher knife. The blade shot between the first and second fingers of his splayed right hand and sawed deep into the flesh at the bottom of the V. Blood poured down. Pickering screamed in pain and surprise. Mostly surprise, she thought. Hyenas don't expect their victims to turn on them. He reached out with his left hand, grabbed her wrist, twisted it. Something creaked, or maybe snapped. Either way, pain bolted up her arm as bright as light. She tried to hold onto the knife, but there was no chance. It went flying all the way across the room, and when he let go of her wrist, her right hand flopped bonelessly, fingers splayed. He bored in on her, and M pushed him backward, using both hands and ignoring the fresh scream of pain from her strained or broken wrist. It was instinct only. Her rational mind would have told her that a push wasn't going to stop this guy, but her rational mind was now cringing in a corner of her head, able to do nothing but hope for the best. He outweighed her, but her bottom was pressed against the chipped lip of the center island. He went staggering backward with a look of startlement that would have been comical in other circumstances, and came down on either one ice cube or a bunch of them. For a moment he looked like a cartoon character, Roadrunner perhaps, sprinting in place in an effort to stay on his feet. Then he stepped on more ice cubes, she saw them go spinning and glinting across the floor, went down hard, and wrapped the back of his head against his newly dented refrigerator. He held up his bleeding hand and looked at it. Then he looked at her.
"You cut me," he said. "You bitch, you dumb bitch, look at this. You cut me. Why did you cut me?"
He tried to scramble to his feet, but more ice cubes went zipping out from beneath him and he thumped down again. He pivoted on one knee, meaning to rise that way, and for a moment his back was to her. M seized the chair's broken left arm from the center island, ragged strands of duct tape still dangled from it. Pickering got to his feet and turned toward her. Emily was waiting. She brought the arm down on his forehead using both hands. Her right one didn't want to close, but she made it. Some atavistic, survival-oriented part of her even remembered to choke up on the red maple rod, knowing it would maximize the force, and maximum force was good. It was a chair arm, after all, not a baseball bat. There was a thump. It wasn't as loud as the swing door had been when he hit it coming in, but it still sounded loud enough, perhaps because the rain had slackened even more. For a moment, nothing else happened. And then blood began to run out of his power haircut and over his forehead. She stared at him into his eyes. He stared back with dazed incomprehension.
"Don't,"
he said feebly, and reached out one hand to take the chair arm in from her. "Yes," she said and swung again, this time from the side. A slicing two-handed blow, her right hand giving up and letting go at the last moment, her left one holding firm. The end of the arm, ragged where it had broken, splinters sticking out, hammered into Pickering's right temple. This time the blood burst at once as his head snapped to the side, all the way to his left shoulder. Bright drops ran down his cheek and pattered onto the gray tile.
"Stop,"
he said thickly, pawing at the air with one hand. He looked like a drowning man begging for rescue.
"No," she said, and brought the arm down on his head again.
Pickering screamed and staggered away from her in a head-tucked hunch, trying to put the center island between them. He stepped on more ice cubes and skidded, but this time managed to stay upright. Only by luck, she had to believe, since he had to be all but out on his feet. For a moment she almost let him go, thinking he would run out through the swing door. It was what she would have done. Then her dad spoke up very calmly in her head. "He's after the knife, sweetie."
"No," she said, snarling at this time. "No, you won't."
She tried to run around the other side of the island and head him off, but she couldn't run, not while she was dragging the shattered remains of the chair behind her like a ball and fucking chain. It was still duct-taped to her left knee. It banged against the island, slammed her in the butt, tried to get between her legs and trip her. The chair seemed to be on his side, and she was glad she had broken it. Pickering got to the knife. It was lying against the bottom of the swing door, and fell on it like a football tackle covering a loose ball. He was making a guttural wheezing sound deep in his throat. Em reached him just as he started to turn over. She hammered him with the chair arm again and again, shrieking, aware in some part of her mind that it wasn't heavy enough and she wasn't generating anywhere near the amount of force she wanted to generate. She could see her right wrist, already puffing up, trying to address the outrage perpetrated on it, just as if it expected to survive this day. Pickering collapsed on the knife and lay still. She backed away a little, gasping for breath, those little white comets once more flying across her field of vision. "He's playing possum, sweetie, just waiting for you to let down your guard." There was a drawer on this side of the island. She yanked it open, hoping for another knife, for lots of them. Carving knives, filleting knives, steak knives, serrated bread knives. She would settle for a goddamn butter knife. What she saw was mostly an array of fancy black plastic cooking tools. Two spatulas, a ladle, and one of those big serving spoons full of holes. There was some other rickrack, but the most dangerous-looking thing her eye fell on was a potato peeler. "Listen to me," she said. Her voice was hoarse, almost guttural. Her throat was dry. "I don't want to kill you, but I will if you make me. I've got a meat fork here. If you try to turn over, I'll stick it in the back of your neck and keep pushing until it comes out the front." Did he believe her? That was one question. Most men had no idea what was in the drawers of their kitchens. She knew this from life with Henry, and before Henry from life with Father. But Pickering wasn't most men. He lived alone, for one thing, she was sure of it. And this wasn't most kitchens. She had an idea it was more like an operating theater. Still, given how dazed he was he dazed? And how he must surely believe that a lapse of memory could get him killed, she thought the bluff might run. Only there was another question. Was he even hearing her? Or understanding her if he did? A bluff couldn't work if the person you were trying to bluff didn't understand the stakes. But she wasn't going to stand here debating. That would be the worst thing she could do. She bent over, never taking her eyes from Pickering, and hooked her fingers under the last band of tape still binding her to the chair. The fingers of her right hand wanted even less to work now, but she made them, and her sweat-drenched skin helped. She shoved downward, and the tape started coming free with another ill-tempered ripping sound. She supposed it hurt. It left a bright red band across her kneecap. For some reason, the word Jupiter floated randomly through her mind. But she was far past feeling such things. It let go all at once and slid down to her ankle, wrinkled and twisted and sticking to itself. She shook it off her foot and sidled backward, free. Her head was pounding, either from exertion or from where he'd hit her while she was looking at the dead girl in the trunk of his Mercedes. "Nicole," she said. Her name was Nicole. Naming the dead girl seemed to bring Em back to herself a little. She considered trying to get the butcher knife out from under him, but the idea seemed like madness. If he was faking, he'd grab her. She also considered looking for another knife. Surely there was one here. But that seemed like pressing her luck. And if she found one, what would she do with it? Defend herself? He had taken the butcher knife away, almost breaking her wrist in the process. Stab him to death with it, as he lay face down and helpless, apparently helpless, against the swing door? She didn't think she was capable of it. Not in cold blood. Which left leaving. Only that. "I'm going now," she said. "Do you hear me?" He didn't move. "I've got the meat fork. If you come after me, I'll stab you with it. I'll poke your eyes out. What you want to do is stay right where you are. Have you got that?" He didn't move. Emily backed away from him, then turned and left the kitchen by the door on the other side of the room. She was still holding the bloody chair arm. Eight. There was a photograph on the wall by the bed. It was the dining room on the other side. There was a long table with a glass top. Around it were seven red maple chairs. The spot where the eighth belonged was vacant, of course. As she studied the empty place at the mother end of the table, a memory came to her, blood blooming in a tiny seed pearl below her eye, as Pickering said, "Okay, good, okay." He had believed her when she said only Dick could know she might be inside the pillbox, so he had thrown the little knife, Nicole's little knife, she had thought then, into the sink. So there had been a knife to threaten him with all along, still was, in the sink. But she wasn't going back in there now, no way. She crossed the room and went down a hall with five doors, two on each side and one at the end. The first two doors she passed were open, on her left a bathroom and on her right a laundry room. The washing machine was a top loader, its hatch open. A box of Tide stood on the shelf next to it. A blood-stained shirt was lying halfway in and halfway out of the hatch. Nicole's shirt, Emily was quite sure, although she couldn't be positive. And if it was hers, why had Pickering been planning to wash it? Washing wouldn't take out the holes. Emily remembered thinking there had been dozens, although that surely wasn't possible. Was it? She thought it was, actually. Pickering in a frenzy. She opened the door beyond the bathroom and saw a guest room. It was nothing but a dark and sterile box, starring a king bed so stringently neat you could no doubt bounce a nickel on the counterpane. And had a maid made up that bed? Our survey says no, Em thought. Our survey says no maid has ever set foot in this house. Only nieces. The door across from the guest room gave on a study. It was every bit as sterile as the room it faced across the hall. There were two filing cabinets in one corner. There was a big desk with nothing on it but a Dell PC hooded with a transparent plastic dust cover. The floor was plain oak planks. There was no rug. There were no pictures on the wall. The single big window was shuttered, admitting only a few dull spokes of light. Like the guest room, this place looked dim and forgotten. "He has never worked in here," she thought, and knew it was true. It was stage dressing. The whole house was, including the room from which she had escaped, the room that looked like a kitchen but was actually an operating theater, complete with easy clean counters and floor. The door at the end of the hall was closed, and as she approached it, she knew it would be locked. She would be trapped at the end of this corridor if he entered it from the kitchen dining room end. Trapped with nowhere to run. And these days, running was the only thing she was good at. The only thing she was good for. She hitched up her shorts. They felt like they were floating on her now, with the back seam split open. And grasped the knob. She was so full of her premonition that for a moment she couldn't believe it when the knob turned in her hand. She pushed the door open and stepped into what had to be Pickering's bedroom. It was almost as sterile as the guest room, but not quite. For one thing, there were two pillows instead of just one, and the counterpane of the bed, which looked like a twin of the guest room bed, had been turned back in a neat triangle, ready to admit the owner to the comfort of fresh sheets after a hard day's work. And there was a carpet on the floor, just a cheap nylon pile thing, but wall to wall. Henry, no doubt, would have called it a carpet barn special, but it matched the blue walls and made the room look less skeletal than the others. There was also a small desk, it looked like an old school desk, and a plain wooden chair. And although this was pretty small shakes compared to the study setup, with its big and unfortunately shuttered window, an expensive computer, she had a feeling this desk had been used. That Pickering sat there writing longhand, hunched over like a child in a country schoolroom, writing what she did not like to think. The window in here was also big, and unlike the windows in the study and the guest room, it wasn't shuttered. Before Em could look out and see what lay beyond, her attention was drawn to a photograph on the wall by the bed. Not hung and certainly not framed, only